Iran strongly condemns new sanctions by the United States against a number of Iranian nationals. The Iraqi parliament approves a law that bans and criminalizes any attempts to normalize relations with Israel. Plus, Ukraine saying that the war in the east of the country is now at its maximum intensity as Russian troops are pushing into the industrial Donbass region. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Iran has strongly condemned the new sanctions announced by the U.S. Treasury Department against several Iranian nationals and entities. The foreign ministry spokesman says that the Iranian armed forces, especially the Quds Force, have always been a nightmare for terrorist groups in the region. Saeed Khatibzadeh says that the U.S. is, quote, the godfather of those terrorist groups and spares no efforts in supporting them. He underlined that the Biden administration is continuing its predecessor's failed maximum pressure policy. He added that the new sanctions are another sign of the U.S. government's ill will toward Iran. On Wednesday, the White House announced new sanctions on a number of Iranian individuals and entities, citing their links to the IRGC that's blacklisted by Washington. Okay, now to get some insight on that, I'm joined by David Yacoubian. He's a professor of history at SCU San Bernardino. Good to have you with us, Professor.
Thank you.
So what's the deal? When you're sitting at a negotiating table, you show each other goodwill, right? Not ill will. I mean, the U.S. cannot impose sanctions at the same time talk about reviving the JCPOA. Is that a joke or something?
Oh, unfortunately, it's not a joke. It's the reality of the American position regarding Iran, unfortunately, going back to 1979. And so I believe that most observers of the JCPOA process of Iran-U.S. relations are aware that there is absolutely no goodwill between Iran and the United States, nor is there any reason, especially for Iran, to look for or to consider American actions to be based on American goodwill. The United States foreign policy is completely designed around the full spectrum dominance global hegemony framework of Paul Wolfowitz, and as well strongly guided, of course, by the interests of the apartheid state of Israel and the despotic kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the region. Therefore, there is no goodwill. There will not be any goodwill. All Iran can rely on in the case of the JCPOA is its own strength, the strength of its political system, the strength of its own resilience and resistance economy. And so thus, to cut to the chase regarding the most recent developments in the JCPOA, I believe if Iran is willing in the short term to humor return to not the JCPOA, but simply a framework where Iran would experience some sanctions relief in exchange for curtailing its civilian nuclear energy program, then perhaps there's still some reason to be discussing the issue in Vienna. But Barack Obama himself, who was the poster boy of the JCPOA, never removed the illegal draconian sanctions that were placed on Iran. They were then, of course, furthered by the Trump regime, and the Biden administration has done nothing to roll back those sanctions. So again, in short, if the interest is in potentially acquiring some form of sanctions relief, then there's something to talk about in Vienna, but there is no goodwill, and the United States remains, unfortunately, agreement incapable.
Okay, appreciate your input. David Yacoubian from San Bernardino. Now, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says in order for the 2015 deal to be revived, there are certain steps that the United States needs to take.
The most important issue is that economic sanctions against Iran need to be removed in an effective way. The maximum pressure policy of the Trump era needs to be lifted. We have kept the window of diplomacy open in order to reach a good and lasting deal. We are determined and we are serious about it. And it has always been us, the Iranian side, that has put initiatives on the table. We have intelligence that the Zionist regime has taken the foreign policy of the United States hostage. Mr. Biden should make the decision. Does he really want to waste the time, or does he want to be brave and return to the commitments under the JCPOA?
Amir Abdullahian said that Iran's demands should not be reduced to the removal of the IRGC from Washington's list of so-called foreign terrorist organizations. He argued that the IRGC's blacklisting is a side issue magnified by the Israeli lobby. The minister said that the imperative to the Islamic Republic is the interests of the Iranian people. The foreign minister was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He said that Tehran should be able to trade normally with other countries with no impediments. Amir Abdullahian said that Biden's White House is following the lead of the previous administration by imposing sanctions on Iran. Journalist and political commentator Abbas Aslani joined a short time ago and said that the U.S. cannot continue its maximum pressure campaign on Iran while, in words, returning to the 2015 nuclear deal.
They want to use the leverage of pressure, sanctions, sabotages against Iran while they claim that they are involved in a diplomatic process. The problem is that the United States wants to keep the maximum pressure policy intact while in words returning to the nuclear deal. And these two things cannot, let's say, happen at the same time. If they want to return to the deal, what Iran argues is that they have to practically return to the JCPOA commitments. They claim that some of the issues raised by Iran are beyond the JCPOA, but let's not forget that many of the sanctions, including the labeling IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization, was done in order to create a wall against any U.S. president to return to the deal. So that's related to the deal, and but they want to keep it in place in order to have a leverage of pressure against Tehran in future, to get more compromises in future, and to somehow create some leverages in order not to let the Iran to benefit economically from the JCPOA.
Now, people in Iran have attended a funeral service in the capital, Tehran, to honor the assassinated IRGC colonel, Hassan Sayyad Khodai. Kisum Shahmadi attended that ceremony and filed a report.
Iranians flocked to a mosque downtown Tehran to pay their respects to the colonel that was fatally shot earlier this week. The attack on Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai, which claimed his life, happened in Tehran on Sunday when two motorcyclists shot him five times while he was in his car and fled the scene.
This assassination simply shows the desperation of Israel and the fact that those behind the attack have reached a point where they can only resort to such brutal attacks in order to discourage us. What they don't know is that martyrdom is considered an honor and strengthens our resolve, and of course such act will not remain unanswered.
The assassination bears the hallmarks of previous deadly shootings in Iran for which Israel has taken responsibility for. But so far, there have been no such official claims. However, the New York Times on Wednesday quoted an Israeli intelligence official saying that Tel Aviv has informed American officials that it was behind the attack.
This is a known policy of our enemies and it is nothing new. State-sponsored terrorism is a basis of their doctrine. Every time they fail, this is what they do. They resort to assassination plots.
The Islamic Republic has been a victim of terrorist attacks since it was established over four decades ago. The last such attack happened in November 2020 when an Iranian scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated.
As you can see, people from all walks of life have come here to attend the ceremony. The message is clear.
Senior Iranian officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi, have condemned the attack in the strongest terms, and Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN has also urged the international community to firmly react to the brutal assassination of the IRGC colonel, who played a significant role in the fight against Daesh and other terrorists in the region.
Those taking part in this funeral ceremony share the same opinion. They all say that every drop of blood gives birth to 100 like-minded people. People who will be walking down the same path as martyr Sayyad Khodai. You kill one, he becomes 100. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Time now for the news review. The Iraqi parliament has unanimously approved legislation that criminalizes any form of normalizing ties with Israel. The parliament said in a statement that the law represents the true reflection of the will of the Iraqi people. The legislative body urged Arab and Islamic parliaments to follow suit. The bill requires all officials, including those in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region, institutions, and media, refrain from establishing relations with the Tel Aviv regime. The UAE, Sudan, Bahrain, and Morocco have established diplomatic ties with Israel, despite backlash from much of the Arab world. The Palestinians condemn the move as a betrayal of their cause and a stab in their back. Okay, let's discuss this a bit and get some insights. So joining me will be Firas Al-Najm. He is a manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights in Ottawa. Also from Canada, we have Eric Welberg, author and journalist in Toronto. Now, Firas, what is it that makes the Iraqi parliament different from some other Arab states, Muslim states, who have clinched those so-called normalization deals with the Tel Aviv regime? Iraqi parliamentarians are unanimous. They're not going to do anything like that.
I'd like to congratulate the Iraqi government and the Iraqi nation for this beautiful development. And the way that things are going now is a little bit different than the way it was going a few months ago, where regimes were jumping on board to normalize and become closer to the Zionist occupiers of Palestine. This is a very, new ignition, and it's a new change in the Middle East, and I think this will open the doors for other governments in the region. I've already heard recently that Algeria is also very much inspired now and willing to do the same thing inside Algeria, and they're speaking about it. So you have people that are going towards supporting Israel, and there's ones that are going now towards supporting Palestine. So this major development is actually a very good change, and it actually also speaks for the nations. I mean, the nation's will and the determination of the nation has a big role in this, because the Iraqi people also are very much aligned with Iran. As we know that, there was major battles that were taking place in Iraq, and we had Major, Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis together, and they really connected together inside Iraq, and that connection really brought them closer to the Palestinian cause, because everything is pretty much interconnected. We know that the terrorists are supported and they support the Israeli regime. This really showed us now that the Iraqi people and the sacrifices of the Popular Mobilization Forces as well, fighting Daesh and all these different groups, now we see the results and what really came out of these murders, these great murders that fought these terrorist organizations that, like I said, are supported by Israel and America and their allies.
Okay. Eric, let's hear your side of the story. What do you think, what factors have brought the Iraqis and their parliamentarians who are unanimous in saying that this is the will of the Iraqi people, actually? What has brought them to this conclusion?
Well, a lot of people see the invasion of Iraq as being inspired primarily by Israel. Certainly all of the advisors of Bush were fanatical Zionists and following Israeli policy. So I think that Iraq has suffered so terribly from imperialism in the last 20 years, that it really, the people have no other emotion but revulsion against Israel and America. And I wish that the U.S. would waken up to the fact that countries are just tolerating it at best, and that it has very few real allies. Mm-hmm. So I think this is an important development. And as Firas said, Algeria is also a strong supporter of Palestine. And there's the Morocco-Algeria. There's Morocco with Israel and Bush, Trump, Mauritania, that kind of dirty politics. And then you've got Algeria that is really, it's very firm and clear, and it doesn't play games with imperialism. Okay. So I think that this is a very good development.
Okay, let me thank our guests from Canada, Firas Alnejm in Ottawa and Eric Waldberg in Toronto. And that's the end of this episode of the News Review. Ukraine says that the war in the east of the country is now at its fiercest level, calling for more support from Kiev's Western allies. The Deputy Defense Minister says the fighting has reached its maximum intensity in the industrial Donbass region. Ghana Maliar says that Russian forces are simultaneously pushing in several directions. She says that Ukraine is facing an extremely difficult and long stage of fighting. Russian forces are said to be closing in on the strategically located Severodonetsk and Lysychansk. Meantime, President Zelensky has urged the West to send more weapons to his country. He's also blasted suggestions that a negotiated peace could include territorial concessions. The British finance minister says high inflation in his country has caused acute distress to people as consumer price inflation has hit a 40-year record. Speaking to Parliament, Rishi Sunak said that the government knows that the people are struggling with the high cost of living. The Chancellor said that he expected the Bank of England to take decisive action to get prices back under control. The finance minister admitted that it will take time to curb the inflation. He said surging energy and food prices aren't the only contributing factors. Unemployment also plays a role. Inflation in the UK hit 9% in April. The Bank of England has forecast the inflation rate will reach double digits by the end of the year. That's a wrap for this broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Because American tax dollars pay for 20% of Israeli regime's entire military budget, the bullet or the gun used to kill Shirin could even been purchased from U.S. weapons manufacturers with Americans' own money. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Phyllis Penis and Richard Falk, writers. This article is published under the heading Why Americans Have a Special Responsibility in the Killing of Shirin Abu Aghele. Stay tuned for more. Shirin Abu Aghele was an Al Jazeera correspondent for the past 25 years. She was known and respected throughout the Arab world for her brave, honest reporting of the Palestinian struggle. On May 11th, she was shot and killed by an Israeli regime sniper while covering an Israeli raid on the Palestinian refugee camp outside Jenin. Abu Aghele's killing in the Israeli-occupied West Bank was shocking, but hardly unusual. According to the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate, she was the 86th journalist to be killed while covering the Zionist regime's oppression since the Zionist regime first occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and East al-Quds in 1967. But the killing of Shirin Abu Aghele is part of a longer pattern of the Zionist regime's violence and collective punishment, not just against journalists, but against all Palestinians committed with impunity and rationalized by trumped-up security concerns. The depth of this abuse was once again made shockingly visible after the killing itself, when the Zionist regime's police attacked a funeral procession carrying Shirin's body to the church. They threw Palestinian flags to the ground and violently beat mourners, including pallbearers who nearly dropped the casket. The killing of Shirin and the assault on the funeral procession demonstrated once again the structural nature of the Zionist regime's racism and violence against Palestinians. As Amnesty International describes it, the Zionist regime's regular violations of Palestinians' rights are not accidental repetitions of offenses, but part of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination. There is no serious question that Abu Aghele was deliberately killed by an Israeli regime sniper. She was wearing a helmet and a blue protective vest marked press and surrounded by other journalists when the group was fired on. She was shot in the head and killed. Another Palestinian journalist was shot and seriously injured. As so often happens, the Zionist regime officials immediately tried to blame the Palestinians. The Zionist regime's officials, from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett on down, made unconvincing claims that Palestinian gunmen were responsible for the killing. Within hours, field workers for the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem easily refuted the Zionist regime's baseless claims. By the time the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, met with the Zionist regime's war minister, Benny Gantz, on May 17th, Tel Aviv had largely pulled back from its claims of Palestinian culpability. The Zionist regime's press claimed that Gantz had indicated, Israel welcomed an investigation of Shirin's killing, but that claim flew in the face of reports that Israel had already decided it would not investigate because questioning the Zionist regime's troops as potential suspects would provoke opposition and controversy within the IDF and Israeli society in general. Such a pattern of denial is but one aspect of a broader pattern of oppression that is much more pervasive. The Zionist regime itself makes no secret of this. The regime's own basic law of 2018 explicitly gives only Jewish citizens of the occupied Palestinian territories, not Palestinian citizens, the right of self-determination. Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, along with B'Tselem, have concluded that this pattern constitutes the crime of apartheid. This international crime and its associated human rights violations and war crimes has continued for decades, while political, diplomatic, economic, and military support from the United States goes forward unconditionally. Washington sends more than $3.8 billion every year directly to the Zionist regime's military, most of it used to purchase U.S.-made weapon systems, ammunition, and more. This makes the U.S. complicit in the Zionist regime's criminal wrongdoing. International engagement is crucial. The International Criminal Court has the authority to add the killing of Shirin Abu Aghele and attacks on Palestinian journalists to its existing investigations of the Zionist regime's crimes. A variety of UN bodies could also respond by issuing reports that offer policy recommendations. Calls for an independent, credible investigation need to include a focus on United States' responsibility. Biden administration officials and some members of Congress have called for an investigation of Abu Aghele's killing. That's welcome, but hardly sufficient. The Zionist regime has a long history of conducting its own investigations and virtually all result in impunity for the Zionist regime's military forces. High-ranking military officials and political decision-makers are never even scrutinized. People in the United States should insist on more. Why? Above all, because American-owned tax dollars pay for 20% of the Zionist regime's entire military budget. The bullet or gun used to kill Shirin could have even been purchased from U.S. weapons manufacturers with Americans' own money. The Leahy Law's restrictions on military aid is unequivocal. No assistance shall be furnished, it says, to any unit of the security forces of a foreign country if the Secretary of State has credible information that such unit has committed a gross violation of human rights. Credible information, including from the Zionist regime's leading human rights organization and five respected journalists standing with Shirin Abu Aghele when she was killed, indicates she was shot in cold blood. If that isn't sufficient, the U.S. State Department should propose an independent UN-based fact-finding team to prepare a report. Militarism is on the rise, both in the United States and around the world. Maybe the brutal killing of Shirin Abu Aghele, a U.S. citizen as well as a proud Palestinian born in Al-Quds, and the police attack on mourners grieving her death will provide an impetus toward rethinking Washington's unconditional support of the Zionist regime's lawlessness.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the privilege and honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sharing your time with us.
The pleasure is mine.
Thank you. We have so many cool topics to discuss on this and future episodes of Muslim Lady. But the important topic that I think we're going to start off with today is regarding the value of having children and child upbringing and the identity of being a mother. Especially in today's age, I feel that being a mother is so degrading for some women in society, and they feel so ashamed among their peers to say that, oh, I'm a housewife, or oh, I'm a stay-at-home mom. They feel like, well, their life is useless and their existence is useless and they don't know what they're doing with themselves, and they don't have that sense of identity anymore. So if we can explain the innate value that's actually interwoven with being a mom and how valuable that is and how valuable it is to raise a child and how hard it is.
Yeah.
I'd really appreciate that.
First of all, well, yeah, what you were saying is absolutely correct. And it's unfortunate and very sad to see that, you know, the people out there, the mothers, feel ashamed of saying that, you know, we are housewives, not thinking about the fact that their task and duty is like 24 hours,
exactly.
I feel, right? Even they have to take care of how their children fall off to sleep. So in a nutshell, parenting is the process of promoting and supporting their physical, the children's physical, emotional, social, intellectual, and spiritual development of a child.
Yeah.
From infancy to adulthood.
Mm.
So it's like an ongoing process, you know? And you have to look at all aspects, not only one aspect. Many people are very smart in doing the worldly bit, you know, providing for the children in the best possible ways, and intellectually also giving the best schools to them.
Education.
And sometimes they lag behind the spiritual aspect and they don't give the religion to them, thinking that they will learn slowly. They'll be matured and learn. But that requires to be ingrained in a very young age so that they can show the fruits later on. As followers of a divinely revealed religion, that is Islam, we appreciate the fact that all of these areas of promotion and support must take place within the legal framework of the teachings of the Quran and the tradition of the Prophet and the Aima alayhi salam. So it's not very, you know, it's not a simple task. And it might be like, okay, now we want to make our family larger to bring up 2, 3, 4 kids. No, you have to think about the fact that how to upbring them.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. So this is not enough at all. You know, like we say that the more the better in the in Islam. And it is encouraged, in fact. But with the condition that you have to know that you have the capacity to bring them up in that way. If you know that you just can't bring them up in this way regarding all the aspects, and you know that you won't get support from probably your spouse, then you have to like think about the process of, you know, family planning. Maybe 2 kids, 3 kids, but the more the better still.
Mm. Because in that case, it's really not fair on the child either, is it?
Yeah, it's not
fair
on the
child. For you to bring a child into this world whom you cannot properly support and raise, and they're just going to end up having been deprived of many of the fundamental needs. It's just so sad, isn't it?
Yeah. But the thing is, one thing we should bear in mind, that as far as the sustenance is concerned, it's from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when sustenance is mentioned, it's mentioned in every aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So the parent should know that, you know, like when I want a child, it's within the innate nature of a parent, of a family, to think about bringing up children in life, in this world. So they should know that the such sustenance is ready for them. As far as the financial sustenance, the spiritual sustenance, all it requires is to take a step forward and do something about it. And Allah will, of course, give a lot of blessings in the process, inshallah. So what are the requirements of parenting first, to know the value of parenting? Let's see of what are the requirements of parenting. We see that there are three prime areas which parents and guardians need to ensure that they look after when they take on this great responsibility of working with the children and to make them the best human beings possible in the earth and the future leaders of Islam. And that's how, you know, that dua that we recite in kunut, Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'yuni waj'alna lil muttaqina imama. And that's what our aim should be, to make them leaders of the muttaqin. That's a very big aim, you know. It's a very high aim, because we want to bring children who are pious, but leaders of the pious.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they are the more pious than the pious also. So this should be our aim. So it's a great responsibility, and there are requirements for this. And the first is the physical security and development of a child. This is the requirement. What is this talking about? The safety of a children's body and his life, that security that he should get. It's not that, like, for example, if a mother is sick, for example, she's facing so much sickness and she can't handle herself also. She knows that she won't be able to provide that safety. You see, as a child is growing up, he needs to be taken care of every step, you know, like a toddler. You need to go after him. So if the mother is physically handicapped, she knows that she can't, unless she has the means, you know, around her. For example, some support, some kind of help to take care of a child. So that becomes a very special thing for her also. So it goes without saying that all people need to have safety and security. And of course, young children more so. So we see the nations spend so much, you know, time and money to ensure this safety and well-being for citizens to be maintained. Like, for example, when this disease of corona had come about, how much was spent, you know, to maintain that safety and security, the bodily security?
Yeah.
So many hospitals were being rebuilt and, I don't know, areas were being taken on for this kind of venture.
Yes.
And so much money was spent and, you know, like research on vaccines and so forth. And I guess still now it might be going on. So the safety, physical safety is very important for one. And that's why, because, you see, this is prime importance, and I mentioned it first, is because we, as human beings, are more acquainted to the nature part of the world, the tabi'a, you know, like our five senses and our zahir. We yearn for these kind of requirements more than when we spiritually grow. You see, it takes a kind of a spiritual maturity to come and understand the religion and the, you know, the aqidah of Islam. Well,
ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady. We are going to go for a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. This is Muslim Lady. I'm joined in the studio by Sister Salma Khalfan, and we are talking about the mother's identity and the value of child upbringing. Sister Salma, I think that in a lot of cases, the more complex, the more contributing the task we have at hand is, and the more physical, psychological and intellectual effort we have to exert in order to fulfill that task, the more valuable it becomes, right?
Absolutely.
And obviously, there is nothing in this world more valuable than the human life, right? As the Quran states that if you take one human life, it's like you've taken all of it. If you save one human life, it's like you've saved all of humanity. And even if we want to look at it from like an evolutionary aspect, we are the most evolved of all living creatures. We are the most complex of all living creatures, most intelligent, so on and so forth. So it's really still so strange for me to understand how is it that the identity of a mother is robbed from her because raising a child has been looked at as something so trivial and insignificant. When it's like she's literally determining the future of humanity.
Yeah.
Right? By what she's doing.
That's right. Absolutely. Actually, you know what? Sometimes it's a wrong influence that touches her through the media and people around her, her peers.
Yeah.
So she loses the interest in what she really yearned for in the first place. Her fitrat, you know, kind of gets covered. Because if you go and see a mother enhances so much, you know, of her existence, her wujud. First of all, her time.
Yeah.
Her time is, like, everybody's time is so invaluable for them, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, we yearn for our space and we want that, you know, time and space to do our things. But a mother, look at herself, sacrifice. She's just, you know, so engrossed in bringing up a child that she wants to not only give her time, that is a real parent I'm talking about and a valuable parent, her, you know, like quality time. You'll see she's trying to find out how to do things with her child so that the child can be healthily, you know, grown up in a perfect state of mind, play with her child, find new items to intellectually grow, you know, her child. And she's doing it with interest too. And those are the real parents out there who do this, the Islamic parents. And you can find these also who are so interested and they don't take, you know, like any influence. Nothing influences them. Whoever tells them whatever, and even if they have so many degrees at hand, they will give up that and they will do what they have to do and they yearn to do and they feel like doing. Which is, it's such a beautiful job if you go and see, like out there we have to struggle and to, you know, to do something and then to work and to come back home and to toil and you get your, you know, like you're some payment at the end of the month or something, or the end of the week. But here a parent has everything ready at hand. That right thoughts, that emotionality, that sustenance promised by Allah, those sawabs ready for her to take care of Allah's amanats, you know. So everything is there, and that interest to do it, and that love. You know, and that's so amazing. It's not as if that, you know, she has to do it and she yearns and loves to do it.
Right.
So time is very important factor, you know, to give the proper time, the quality time. And that's when, you know, we sometimes really stress the men, the spouses, their, you know, their husbands, to also give quality time to the children.
Course,
because the two parents together make a healthy child, you know.
That's very important. You're right. And that's definitely something we're going to touch upon in further episodes of Muslim Lady. But that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger to Allah.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, a dizzying week featured Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, caught lying, and another lawmaker, Marjorie Taylor Greene, grilled under oath about her role in the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by the congressional correspondent for the New York Times, Jonathan Weissman. The piece is titled, For Trump's GOP, Crossing Lines Has Few Consequences. There was a time in the United States Capitol when lines mattered, and when they were crossed, the consequences were swift and severe. Speaker Jim Wright, a Democrat, lost his job in 1989 amid charges of corruption and profiteering. Almost a decade later, Speaker Newt Gingrich, a Republican, lost his job after disappointing midterm elections. Newt Gingrich's expected successor, Robert Livingston, then admitted he had violated the public's trust by having an extramarital affair, even as he demanded President Bill Clinton's resignation for having an affair with a White House intern, and bowed out on his own. More recently, in rapid succession, Senator Al Franken of Minnesota and Representative John Conyers of Michigan, both Democrats, were forced to exit Congress amid charges of sexual harassment during the hashtag MeToo era. On the Republican side, Representative Blake Farenthold of Texas, Patrick Meehan of Pennsylvania, and Trent Franks of Arizona were also driven out of office by allegations of sexual impropriety. Yet when the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, was shown to have lied about his response to the deadliest assault on the Capitol in centuries and President Donald Trump's culpability for that attack, there was little expectation that the consequences would be either swift or severe, or that there would be any consequences at all. Dissembling is not a crime, but doing so to conceal a wholesale reversal on a matter as serious as an attack on the citadel of democracy and the possible resignation of a president would once have been considered career-ending for a politician in the United States, particularly one who aspires to the highest position in the House of Representatives. Not so for a Republican in the age of Donald Trump, when Kevin McCarthy's brand of lie was nothing particularly new. Maybe it was just a Thursday. On Friday, another House member, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, said under oath at an administrative law hearing in Atlanta, Georgia, that she could not recall having advocated Donald Trump impose martial law to stop the transfer of power to Joseph R. Biden Jr., a position that would seem difficult to forget. It's a tragic indictment of the political process these days and the Republican Party of late that truth doesn't matter anymore. Words don't matter. Everybody can be elastic in areas where once viewed as concrete, said Mark Sanford, a former Republican governor of South Carolina who lied to the public about his whereabouts when he was pursuing an extramarital affair in South America and was censured by the State House of Representatives. You cross lines now, and there are no longer any consequences. Mark Sanford's political comeback as a Republican member of the House ended when he crossed the one line that still does matter in his party. He condemned Donald Trump as intolerant and untrustworthy. Donald Trump called him nothing but trouble, and Mark Sanford was defeated in a primary in 2018. It was Donald Trump himself who showed just how few consequences there could be for transgressions that once seemed beyond the pale for the nation's leaders in 2016, when he survived the release of leaked audio in which he boasted of sexually assaulting women, then went on to win the presidency. In the year afterward, he survived two impeachment trials on charges of pressuring Ukraine for his own political gain and of inciting the Capitol riot, and he continues to spread the lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Those episodes were vivid proof, if any were needed, that tribalism and party loyalty now outweigh any notion of integrity or even steadfast policy beliefs. But if there were any questions about whether the end of Donald Trump's presidency would begin to restore old mores and guardrails, the past months have put those thoughts to rest. Last month, Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, angered fellow Republicans by saying lawmakers he looked up to had invited him to parties involving sex and cocaine. The allegations drew condemnation from Kevin McCarthy, who told Republican lawmakers that Madison Cawthorn had later admitted they were untrue, though the House leader stopped short of punishing him. In Missouri, Eric Greitens, who resigned from the governorship in 2018 amid charges of sexual impropriety. When his ex-wife accused him of domestic violence in a sworn affidavit last month, he pressed on, near the top of the polls, saying she was being manipulated by Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, and Karl Rove, President George W. Bush's former political advisor. The Greitens campaign has received tremendous support from donors and patriots across the country who see the deception and lies peddled by establishment rhinos. All Republicans in name only, said Dylan Johnson, his campaign manager. Since they launched those unfounded attacks in the last few weeks, the campaign has seen an exponential increase in the rate of donations, sign-ups and engagement. Kevin McCarthy's latest travails with the truth are reminiscent of the last time he had the speakership in his grasp and instructive about how Donald Trump has changed the political landscape in America. Representative Charlie Crist of Florida, who was a Republican governor of his state before he became a Democratic congressman, listed that honesty wasn't important today as it was when Abraham Lincoln was extolled as Honest Abe, and a myth grew up around George Washington, admitting he had chopped down a cherry tree because he could not tell a lie. Charlie Crist of Florida is now seeking the governorship as a Democrat, and he said on Friday that if he won a contested primary, he planned to make honesty central to his campaign to unseat the current governor of Florida, Republican Ron DeSantis. It already is part of this campaign, he said. It needs to be, and it should be. It goes to the core essence of integrity. For Republicans, the ultimate arbiter of lines not to be crossed and the consequences to be paid remains Donald Trump. For now, the former president signaled all is fine with Kevin McCarthy. I think it's all a big compliment, frankly, he told the Wall Street Journal on Friday. If Donald Trump decides the House leader, Kevin McCarthy, must pay for his prevarications or for the truth he tried to hide, the price is still could be high. Take it from the one who knows, Mark Sanford. Mark Sanford says, we live in very strange times in politics. He said that he was hustling to his son's wedding rehearsal dinner. I hope they can self-correct, but I worry that they can't.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.